Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's that toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, as always, some interesting research to talk over during the hour.
Yes, we're going to talk about some research, new research on bisexuality that goes against some old research, and we'll find out what is good science here and what is junk science.
Mm-hmm. And
we're going to talk about Alzheimer's disease, some new data that shows how you walk may be a predictor as to whether or not you're developing Alzheimer's disease. Very interesting new data that has just come out.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we'll all recognize a recipe from the vault.
Yes, a recipe from the vault. Nutty rice salad. We have had lots of requests for this. It sounds nutty, but it's really good, and it's great this time of year. You will love it. I guarantee it.
And as I said, we'll all, of course, remember it from
the
way
vault.
Back then. To the phones we go now, Zorba, and let's welcome a listener in Rapid City, South Dakota. Rapid City, welcome.
Hi.
How can we help?
I have a question about lung cancer and running. My mom died of lung cancer and stomach cancer at 43. Mm. And, as a child of a smoker, I have 15 years of secondhand smoke exposure. And a couple of years ago, I took up running a bit more seriously than I had in the past, putting on about 10 or 30 miles per week, mostly on trails if weather permits. And all athletes worry about physical injuries that are directly related to their sport. But I have developed a fear about illness taking me out of my sport. I was wondering if you had come upon any evidence that running and exercise can cut lung cancer risk.
You know, these fears, by the way, are very, very common. And I'll tell you something because it really affects me. And I had a lot of smoke involved when I was young, but my mom died of Alzheimer's disease. So for years and years and years, especially a few years ago, she died back in 81. When I would forget something, I would think, oh my gosh, am I developing Alzheimer's disease? But I have in my office, one of my younger partners who's 16 years younger than I am, he never had that fear. His mom is still around. And, and she didn't die from it. And every time he forgets something, it makes me feel good. That means I don't have Alzheimer's because he's not worried about it. You know, it's a very strange thing. The secondhand smoke is quite fascinating. The risk of lung cancer drops pretty much to zero from secondhand smoke after about 20 years. You know, it's probably after 10 years, but it's definitely after 20 years. Your mom was 43. How many years ago did she die?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. So you still have some risk from the secondary smoke in the house. And actually, you have a little bit of risk of chronic lung disease because you were around that smoke. And that's probably, that's there, but it's a small risk. My mom smoked. My grandpa smoked. He lived with us for a bunch of years. My father smoked cigars. Everyone in the family, my family smoked. It was a cloud in the house. So I know what you're talking about. Most smokers, by the way, they never die of lung cancer. Most smokers lose roughly 10 years of life. Only 20% of them get lung cancer, and the rest of them get heart disease and stroke and chronic bronchitis and emphysema. They die from a whole bunch of other things. But lung cancer is pretty rare, and your risk is pretty small, but I don't think exercise drops that risk at all. Not at all. I don't think it affects lung cancer. However, exercise reduces your risk of heart attack and stroke and increases your lungs' ability to actually function well. So when we look at 80% of the other diseases that you may get from secondhand smoke, exercise is dynamite. So in other words, you're cutting that risk by a lot by engaging in exercise. The other 80% that basically gets smokers. I think keeping on your healthy lifestyle, diet, and exercise program is your best shield from basically dying of these diseases. And so, of course, for the rest of your life, staying away from secondhand smoke, which is pretty easy to do today.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, any children of smokers, I'm sure, would attempt to do that.
Wise
ones.
Absolutely. The wise ones. Yeah. Just what you said. Well, thank you for sharing your wise decisions with us.
Oh, thanks.
Sure. Interesting call. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, here's a listener with us in Clinton, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. What's up?
My question for you is, I have history of digestive problems ever since I was pretty young. Everything I ate went right through me. Mm-hmm. I was anemic. I struggled a lot with stomach cramps and bloating, and nothing helped. I met a new friend who had celiac disease, and she said, maybe it's gluten. Maybe you should try giving up gluten. I'd never heard of gluten, but I did some research, and it's in pretty much everything. It's in a lot of different foods, but I tried it. I gave it up, and within 3 days, all of my symptoms disappeared. I felt amazing for the first time in a decade. I felt better within days, and now I get really sick when I eat even a bite of gluten, but... what I didn't know at the time was that you can't be tested for celiac disease if you give up gluten. It all goes out of your system, and they can't test for it in the same way. So at this point, I've been gluten-free for a couple of years, but I don't have an official celiac diagnosis, and I don't know if it's worth going back on gluten, if there's any medical benefit to having an official celiac diagnosis, or if I just know it makes me feel better, so I'm good.
Getting back to that, there happens to be a lot of gluten intolerance, and once we once we actually found not just a blood test, but found that you can actually take people off of gluten, it turns out it's much more common than we ever thought. And for many, many people, it's a kind of a minor annoyance. They never noticed it, but when they went to Frank's Pasta Joint, they got sick, and they associated with Frank's Pasta Joint when, in fact, it really was the pasta in Frank's restaurant that did it. And I'm sure you know just what I'm talking about. Have you noticed now you can find more gluten-free bakeries and you can buy food that is gluten-free?
Oh, it's so much easier than it used to be, even within the 2 years
Absolutely.
That I've been eating this way. Yeah.
It's a bull market in gluten-free stuff. Let me tell you that. It really is. And wheat isn't everything. You're exactly right. It's sort of, you know, it's you know, wheat and peanuts. There's certain things that are in everything. So is there an advantage to being tested? Absolutely not. There is no advantage. Because if you get the blood test and it's positive, you'll say, hey, look, I'm positive for this. I really shouldn't have gluten. And if you get the blood test and it's negative, you're not going to believe the blood test. I mean, the blood test is not going to be a decision point in what you're doing. You've noticed gluten is the issue. And if you want to test to see whether or not gluten is the issue, it's really simple. Start eating gluten, start eating products that are gluten again and see what happens. And if it happens every time, you'll see it. I mean, to me, that's it. I think the test is worthwhile for people who are unsure or they want to they would like to have gluten again and they want to make a decision point. I think that's where it's worthwhile. But otherwise, not. And by the way, the real test is going back on a gluten diet and then having a biopsy of your small intestine. I mean, that's really the test.
Right, and that was the one that was recommended. And you have to go back on it for 4 to 6 weeks.
That's different.
I can't leave the house.
That's exactly it. But the blood test, to my knowledge, you don't have to, which is really pretty good. It's not the gold standard. You don't have to go back on it. But yes, if they were to do a sample of your small intestine, you would have to be on gluten for 4 to 6 weeks. Absolutely. But we don't do that biopsy anymore, except in conditions where we're not sure what's going on. And
okay.
In your case,
we
are sure, right? We are sure.
We are sure. For better or for worse.
So I've got a question for you. What do you do with your buddies when you go out to a restaurant? How do you handle it?
There are a lot of restaurants that have gluten-free options now. Mm-hmm. But if people want to go to a place that doesn't, I'll just bring my own, or I'll sit there and drink a Coke and hang out with friends because food and fellowship go together, especially in Wisconsin. You probably know that.
There you go.
There you go, as we say. Thanks a lot for your call.
We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Have you been to Frank's pasta joint lately? It's been a while for me.
I have some name, Frank's Pasta Joint. You looked at me and rolled your eyes, and I thought, where did that name come from? No, I have never, ever been to Frank's Pasta Joint. But I've heard it's really, really good, and they give you a lot of food for very little money.
I'll take you out there sometime.
Thanks.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, some research on bisexual men. It's been wondered through a long time whether bisexual men, in quotes, were really bisexual. And here's some research to talk about.
Well, this has sort of been something that's been bantered around for many, many years.
Right.
From Kinsey at the very beginning on to Masters and Johnson to the fact that, there are gay men and women, and then there are heterosexual men and women, and there's really nothing in between. And there kind of was a thought that really one is masquerading as another, and it doesn't really exist where men and women can be stimulated by, not just one sex, the same or opposite sex, but by both. And so there were a number of articles that came out, one specific article that sort of years ago, quote, disproved bisexuality as actually existing, saying that really bisexuality didn't exist. But when you look back at the research that was done, they looked for subjects in the study by advertising in gay literature.
So, to do those older studies.
Yes, in the older studies. So, I mean, come on. I mean, if you're advertising in The Advocate, which was a gay newspaper, you're much more likely to get gay men to actually go on to the study. But in this study, they were much more – they did a much better job at recruiting patients. And what they did was they had men, and this was a male study. They actually – they monitored their erectile dysfunction with electrodes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can picture you're sitting there with some sort of electrodes on your on your genitals, and then they showed them pornography. So, and they showed them male pornography and female pornography, and they showed them bisexual pornography and so on. Lo and behold, what they discovered, the long and the short of it, if you will, was, no pun intended, was the fact that indeed, there are some men who are stimulated by both males and females.
So that's what bisexuality in men is a reality.
Yeah. No, it actually is a reality. Yeah. Now, an interesting sort of part of the article and the material that I read about the article is there are advocacy groups, as there are for all people in our society, for bisexuality. And some groups said, well, this is good. This is research. It's showing, indeed, this is the case. And other groups panned the research. And they said, the fact that we bisexuals are attracted to men and women is not just measured by our genital response, that it's also measured by how we think about things, how we think about ourselves, how we look at the world. And what you're doing is you're barking up the wrong tree. What we should really be looking at is what attracts us to both men and women. And to me, I think the important aspect of this is that it shows that human sexuality is in many ways much, much broader than we really give it credit for.
Yeah.
Much, much broader than
I'm not surprised by this research. Almost nobody questions women as to whether they can be bisexual or not. And why, if it's a given that women can be bisexual, why in the world?
Right. It wouldn't make any sense. That's right. And I think the importance of the research is it says, hey, women are often bisexual. Men are often bisexual. It really is another variation of human behavior, and that's just fine.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I'm calling because my husband has managed to stump our family doctor here in town. About 6 months ago, he and a lot of other people around us, some members of my family and friends, we all kind of got sinus infections, which some people went and had antibiotics, cleared them up. Some just went away by themselves. But my husband is still suffering from it. He went to the family doctor, and our family doctor prescribed another course of antibiotics, which he finished, and he was still suffering, congested, sinus headaches. He uses a neti pot, and he's been using a neti pot for years, and it doesn't seem to help or change anything.
Steroid nasal sprays at all?
Well, then after the second course of antibiotics, the doctor prescribed Flonase and Allegra D.
Okay, good.
And he's been doing that for 3 weeks.
How's he feeling?
It still is changing anything or helping him.
Okay, has he had a CT scan of his sinuses at all? Head scan?
No.
I think I'd do that. You know, he's got some recurrent things, and the question is what's going on. Has he been seen by an ENT doc to see if he's got polyps?
Nope.
That's what I would do, too. What happens is sinuses are air cavities in our skull, and the theory of why they developed in the first place is to make our head lighter so we can move it around and see, see bears that are coming to attack us. Otherwise, we'd have a big, heavy, boulder on top of our head, and we'd have these big muscles. We wouldn't be able to move it much. But that's the theory, and it's lined with mucous membranes, just like with your nose. And when you get a sinus infection, we treat it with an antibiotic, even though most are viral. When you actually go in and pull out some fluid, you don't find bacteria in there. We assume they're viral. Some people believe they're not viral, but they're actually due to a fungus infection or yeast infections. And there's some issues with that. We don't really quite know what they are. But recurrent infections can also happen because of an architectural problem such as polyps. So polyps in the back of the nose that just don't allow drainage to occur properly. That's one issue. And sometimes there actually are other things in the sinuses that occur that show there's an air fluid level, which means you really have a significant infection and you've got to get higher dose antibiotics for a longer period of time. So that's what I would do after you've had failure and you just haven't had it cleared. He needs a look up his nose with a flexible scope by an ENT doctor, and I think he needs a CAT scan to see what's going on. That's what I would do.
That's going to be hard to convince him to do. Uh-huh.
Why, is he a therapeutic nihilist?
Yeah, he doesn't like doctors.
Doesn't like doctors. Yeah. So another suggestion besides that is just to stay on antibiotics for 4 to 8 weeks, because sometimes that'll do it too. I generally find that men, and this is absolutely sexist, but men, if you make an appointment and they have to cancel it, 9 out of 10 times they'll go to the appointment. If you ask them if you can make an appointment, they'll get into their male pattern. They'll stand up tall and get all huffy, and they'll say, I don't want to do that. And I'm serious about that in a collegial, funny way. But if you make the appointment, you say, this is the appointment. If you want to cancel it, you go cancel it. Chances are more likely than not that he'll go there. Mm-hmm. And that's what he needs. Somebody's got to look and see if there are polyps there. That's what I would recommend.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good luck to you. Let us know what happens.
Okay, thanks.
We appreciate the call. Bye-bye. And before the break, Zorba, let's quickly turn the floor over to our listeners who have lots to say about a recent call. You might recall that not too long ago, we had a woman call in to tell us her husband was allergic to their shower. You were pretty much stumped and recommended that she consult her dermatologist. Well, our inbox quickly filled with plenty of listener theories. A listener named Carol writes, Zorba, I'm very surprised you said that water is neutral. Tap water has chemicals in it and can cause the type of symptoms your caller said her husband experienced when he showers. It is worth putting a good quality filter on the shower. I'm willing to bet he will receive much relief.
Well, it's an interesting concept. She's right. It's not neutral. It has chlorine. And I don't think filters really remove chlorine. I'm not sure if they do.
There are some that do. Yeah.
So maybe a chlorine issue. That certainly could be it. I hadn't even thought about the fact that chlorine is the case, because in my house, we happen to live in the country and we have no chemicals in our water. I'll invite him to come over to shower with me in my house. Well, maybe not with me, but at my house.
Okay,
you know,
Carol.
You can come over and, Carol, we'll figure out the chemical problem.
Yeah, Carol, here is Zorba's address.
That's right.
A listener named Joan ponders another theory. Wouldn't it be more likely that it's a neurological issue and that the spray from the shower overstimulates some nerve reaction? What if he tried a bath?
I think that's a great idea. Now, Tom, I have a question for you. When was the last time you took a bath?
Oh, boy, it's been probably when I was 9 years old.
That's exactly it. I mean, we don't take baths in our society.
Don't.
However, that person is right. I certainly would try the bath to see if water is the issue or the spray is the issue, and that is a great idea. Please, go on. Give me more.
Finally, Dr. Lin, a former Northwestern dermatologist, thinks the solution of baby oil may be compounding the problem. Just wanted to let you know that baby oil is mineral oil plus fragrance, and fragrance is the most common cause of skin allergy. Your advice to see a dermatologist is a good one. A real Sherlock Holmes-type approach is always helpful when diagnosing skin allergies that are not clearly related to one product or another.
I love it. I love it. The advice to see a dermatologist is well-founded, as said by the dermatologist. I guess that makes a lot of sense. And baby oil, I had no idea that baby oil was actually mineral oil with fragrance added to it. And when I was a kid, a lot of the young girls in my high school would go to the beach and put on baby oil with iodine added to it and go to the beach to try to get a tan, because the idea was you had a few drops of iodine in baby oil and it'll improve the tan. And I'm sure all of those girls who went to the beach now are thinking about their basal cell carcinoma that's caused by the baby oil. Mineral oil is kind of yuck that you would have it. So anyway, great idea. And I love that as a concept that it may be the fragrance.
And of course, we like hearing from you. Just send your comments, tips, and questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe from the vault coming up. More of your calls, of course. Some more interesting research to talk over and our medical myth buster later. Right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, it is recipe time. And today, a listener named Mary Beth from Madison, Wisconsin, has put a quarter into the recipe vault jukebox and placed her request. Mary Beth writes, "I'm looking for your nutty rice salad recipe. I gave it away to a friend of mine and can't find it on your website."
See, now that was the problem. She gave it away. See, if she had kept it in her basement, like I keep everything in my basement, she wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah, but luckily for her, after some digging through our famous and well-secured recipe vault, which I'm pretty sure is just an old rusty file cabinet, show producer Adam Friedrich found your requested recipe. Now, don't give it to anyone.
No,
just kidding,
right.
Because it's getting a second run in the sun, and it'll be archived eternally on our website.
Second run in the sun? Where did you get that from?
Oh, right up the top of my head. So, without further ado, here's the encore presentation of Nutty Rice Salad.
I'm stuck on second run in the sun because we're in the studio where there is no sun. I mean, you can't tell what's going on outside.
And in a state where there's very little sun.
That's right, a state where there's not a lot.
And in a state of confusion.
But we're happy people in our state.
Yes,
we're,
we are.
You know, we're number two on the happiness scale. Did you know that? I don't know what where number one is, but we're right up there when you measure happiness in Wisconsin. I'm not fooling you. We're not in the middle of the pack. We're not in the bottom of the pack. We're right up there as a happy state.
I'm sure it's because everybody listens to Zorba Pastor and is healthy and happy. Anyway, let's do the recipe from the vault.
All right, enough with that. Okay, so first of all, the dressing. Let's talk about the dressing. Mm-hmm. 2 tablespoonfuls of fresh lime juice.
2 big tea. Fresh lime juice.
Now, you cannot use reconstituted lime juice. It does not work. It's got to be fresh. Go to the store.
Get a lime.
Did you say get a life?
Lime. 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 Lime.
Get a life. Go to the store. Get away from the radio. Get a life. But actually, it's 1 lime. That'll be about 2 tablespoonfuls. Mm-hmm. 2 tablespoonfuls of red wine vinegar.
2 big tea red wine vinegar.
And you could use apple cider vinegar. That would be okay, but not balsamic, because that will overpower it.
Okay.
And I know that in your house, you've got several different kinds of vinegar, right?
Well, we have 1 or 2.
Yeah, 1 or 2. Well, that's two is several. Yeah. Is several just more than 1, do you think?
Yeah.
One can't be several. But
it has to be more than 2 also.
I think several is more than 2. I've had an argument with people over time, and they say 2 can be several.
No.
I think of several as 3 or more, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's what I think of. I wonder if our listeners have any thoughts.
Probably not.
Probably not. one tablespoon full of, go to the phone and when you request it. One tablespoon full of honey Dijon mustard.
A big tea, honey Dijon mustard.
A bunch of scallions chopped.
A bunch of chopped scallions.
3/4 teaspoon of salt.
3/4 little tea salt.
A teaspoon of hot pepper sauce.
A little tea hot pepper sauce.
Now, what do you use when you use hot pepper sauce?
What do you mean?
In your house. I have Tabasco. I mean, that's what I have. I used to have like 4 or 5 different kinds.
We do. Have 4 or 5 different kinds because we like chili and
I do. I used to have a Mexican sauce and Vietnamese sauce and a vinegar. But whatever hot pepper sauce is you like here. Half a cup of olive oil, extra virgin only.
Half a cup of extra virgin olive oil.
Okay. And then now we're going to go on for the rice, the part that is sort of dry. You're going to use 4 cups of vegetable broth.
4 cups of vegetable broth.
Now, you can use water if you want to, but canned vegetable broth, low sodium is preferred. Buy the low sodium because it has better taste.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And in fact, that's now the case with all broths. Consumer Reports did an excellent article, and Cooks Illustrated also published some information that showed that low-sodium broths have more taste because the salt is cheaper than adding – if you add more veggies or more chicken, you need that in order to overcome the lack of salt.
Oh,
so low-sodium broth is always a tastier broth. 2 cups of long grain rice.
2 cups of long grain rice.
1.5 teaspoons of salt.
1.5 little tea salt.
Couple of bay leaves.
2 bay leaves.
3 teaspoons of dry oregano crumbled.
3 little tea, dry oregano crumbled.
Now, I guess we could say 1 tablespoonful of dry oregano. We just didn't convert that, but... For those of you who know, 1/2 cup of sliced almonds.
1/2 cup of sliced almonds.
1/3 cup of capers drained.
1/3 cup of capers drained.
Can you see how tasty this is going to be?
Yeah, it is. It really is.
3 tablespoonfuls of chives, fresh chopped chives.
3 big tea chives,
and,
fresh chopped.
And then S&P off to the side.
Right.
So let's prepare the dressing. Mm-hmm. That was the first part. In a small bowl, whisk together lime juice, vinegar, mustard, scallions, salt, hot pepper sauce. Gradually whisk in the olive oil. Last, set it aside and, you know, taste it. See if it's the right taste for you. Then prepare the rice. In a large, heavy saucepan, bring the vegetable broth to a boil. If you've got a rice cooker, just put it in the rice cooker. Add the rice. Add the salt, bay leaves. Mix it well. Cover it. Reduce the heat. Simmer until all the broth is absorbed. And if you don't have a rice cooker, I highly recommend you get one. We bought a rice cooker when we were first married, Penny and I, and we still have the same rice cooker. It has lasted forever. Is that because we're cheap or we're just good with our appliances? That's what I want to know. But the new rice cookers look exactly as the same. Anyway, remove the bay leaves, transfer to a large bowl, add the dressing and oregano, toss it well, cover and refrigerate about 2 hours. Once chilled, that's when it's chilled, mix in the almonds, the capers, the chives. Then taste it and see whether or not you want to add some S&P, and you are done. It's a wonderful, wonderful recipe. It's a great side dish to pass, and I know that many public radio people out there often go to events in the fall.
Yep.
And they're looking for a side dish to pass. And in the spring and the summer, it's a great side dish to pass. You will get rave reviews on this dish when you serve it because it's a very, very interesting, nutty rice salad taste.
And Mary Beth, thanks a lot for requesting this, giving us a chance to redo it.
And have it see the sun. See the sun.
If there's a recipe you forgot to jot down or gave to a friend, let us know about it, and it might just end up being our next recipe.
Recipe from the vaults.
Just send the name of the recipe in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on your health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. Oh, and you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba, as does our next listener from Ripon, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom. See, I've got a question. What effect does microwave radiation have on nutritional content of food? And also, aren't cell phones, aren't they also a source for microwaves, and is that harmful?
Do we allow two questions from one listener?
It all depends. He's a Wisconsin listener, so we allow them as many questions as they want to because it keeps our state happy. We're a happy state, and we want to stay happy.
Okay. So let's handle both of them.
Let's handle both questions. Yeah. Well, first of all, the microwave question. It depends on how hot the food is. It's no different than, basically it's shaking. I mean, microwaves are another form of energy, and when you heat things up, you change them. So vitamins are destroyed by heat. So a great way to destroy vitamins is to take peas, for instance, canned peas, and boil them like my mother did until they're awful mush, and you will have no benefit at all except for the fiber in the peas. I mean, there are no vitamins. So boiling is actually much, much worse than microwaving. But it depends. Now, when you microwave things, what are you microwaving?
Mostly heating up food.
Mm-hmm. Right. Reheating food. That's what most people do.
Yeah.
If you are reheating food and you're heating it to the point where it tastes as warm as you want it, you are doing a better job from maintaining the nutrition within the food than if you take the food and you put it in the oven and you take it out and it's too hot. In other words, you've destroyed more vitamins by overheating it in the oven than you will in the microwave. Yeah. So microwaves are just fine.
What about cell phones?
I don't heat my food with a cell phone.
No. I mean his cell phone question.
What was the cell phone question? It's gone out of my mind. I'm busy stuck on the microwave.
Well, I've heard different things about cell phones being harmful to the brain.
Well, the European Union.
I guess, by the way, that was the reason we don't usually take two questions.
Because I can't keep it in my mind. I was stuck with cell phones and microwaves. Well, let me talk about cell phones. I was a total disbeliever in the cell phone issue until the European Union came out with a statement that they believe that there is reasonable cause to believe that there may be, and these are a bunch of words that they use, reasonable cause and may be, an increase in certain forms of brain cancer from holding the cell phone up to our ears all of the time. And I think it was a glioblastoma that they were looking at. I might be wrong on that, but I think it was a glioblastoma. And the feds chimed in and said, well, we're still looking at it and we don't see the data the same way they see the data. So I think it's sort of one of these risks that you look at. You know, we all take risks. You go out on a sunny day in your car, there's less risk than when it's cloudy or rainy or snowing or icy or dark. In other words, there are all different risks that are involved in terms of driving, and we accept that risk. I think the data now shows that cell phones may have a risk. I think that's the data, may have a risk. Mm-hmm. You can reduce that risk by using a Bluetooth because you're not next to the cell phone, and you're not getting the energy that basically the cell phone is coming from the cell phone. I don't want to use the word irradiating out because that's not what's really happening, mm-hmm. but it's actually the waves that are coming off from the cell phone. So I think use your Bluetooth with your cell phone and you're better off. Besides, my wrist hurts when I hold my cell phone up to my ear, and that really bothers me. Thanks for your double call. Anyone from Wisconsin gets two shots of the can.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sure. Bye-bye. By the way, whenever you talk about government studies or government, I love it when you refer to them as the feds, because I think of Elliot Ness and his men.
And the feds. Right. The feds are coming in. Those are the people from the FDA. They're the feds. They've got the hat on just like Elliot Ness. That's right.
Well, before we...
and they're packing.
Before we take our short break, Zorba, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc, although today's edition might be better named Defending and Disagreeing with the Doc. I'll let Cynthia from El Paso, Texas, explain. She writes, "My dearest Dr. Zorba and Mr. Clark."
Dearest. I think that's one step more than respect. I think that's sort of like really friendly. It's a really friendly way to address
it. She goes on, "I call you dearests because your amazingly wonderful laughter feeds my heart as I drive home from work in El Paso, Texas."
How sweet. How sweet.
Dr. Zorba, you made a comment that seemed to imply that pico de gallo might be made without the cilantro. Sorry, it is no longer pico de gallo without the cilantro. It would just be chopped vegetables. Having lived in the Southwest my entire life and in El Paso for the last 25 years, I believe myself qualified to comment. And now she's here to defend you. As to raw crab, I have married into the precious Korean community and have been introduced to food items and combinations of food items that are no less than mind-boggling. The Korean spicy marinated raw crab dish, transliterated jjajang, is as adventurous as it gets. Blue crab is marinated in a red chili soy and spice sauce for a few days in the fridge and then eaten raw, at least by my Korean family. They seem to enjoy it immensely when served on special occasions.
Wow. Well,
I remember the objection to raw was that you can't get it out of the shell unless you cook
it.
Right, but apparently,
apparently, if you marinate, it's really the preparation. And I eat raw fish when I eat sushi. So, of course, it makes sense that you could eat raw crab. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. And that's what's so wonderful about eating adventurous food from different cultures.
That's great. And I don't eat raw fish when I don't eat sushi.
That's right. And you are not an adventurous eater by definition, the Tom Clark method.
If you want to disagree or defend Public Radio's favorite family doc, just send your thoughts to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another interesting topic to talk about. More of your calls, our medical Mythbuster 2, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number is 1-800-462-7413. You'll find a line open now. But before we get back to the phones, Zorba, some really interesting research on Alzheimer's and a possible predictor for
Alzheimer's. That's right, a predictor. You've looked at how people walk. I mean, I happen to study how people walk. I kind of like it. So if you're on a college campus, you look at people walk and they have a lilt in their step, you know, kind of a jump in their step. And as people get older and they get more arthritis, they slow down, they don't walk the same. Well, that's really due to muscles and ligaments and arthritis and in joints. This is different. What they did was they looked at how patients with dementia were walking. And what they discovered was an early predictor of dementia might be a slowing or an imbalance in how they walk. In other words, the first sign of Alzheimer's disease might be a change in your gait.
Yeah. But as you just said, we all, as we age, change our gait. So how is this different from that?
Well, we walk differently. So what they did, and there were five different studies presented recently at a convention in Vancouver, and all the studies pretty much show the same thing. For the most part, they looked at people, they looked at how they walked, they measured them in some studies with sensors to see what their balance was like, what their gait was like. Then they measured it sometimes a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later to see how they were walking. Some were normal people, some were people with mild dementia, either the beginning of Alzheimer's disease or the beginning of what we call multi-stroke dementia. And what they discovered was a change in their gait. In other words, these were patients who didn't have a lot of arthritis, but a change in the way they walked tended to predict what their memory was going to be like years later.
Must be a matter of degree of change.
Well, right. The degree might be very small. And once again, this is new research, but it may be that a precursor to whether or not you have Alzheimer's is this gait change. So what we may find is that you've got a memory disturbance and you wonder whether or not you're coming down with Alzheimer's. My mom had Alzheimer's, so it's something I might worry about. You may end up in the near future going and getting a gait analysis, and it may say, you know, you're not walking exactly right. You may have Alzheimer's. The beginning of that, what can we do to make sure your memory is intact?
Now, we all know we should exercise. Can we jump from this research to saying that if we really focus on walking and walking and doing a good job of walking and not, that we will not get Alzheimer's?
Absolutely not. I don't think think that's from that at all. We do know that people who exercise have less dementia. We know that. We know that people who jog, people who exercise have less dementia. It may be a chicken and egg kind of a thing. They may just be different. I don't think you can say that walking helps your memory. I think this is a sign, a possible sign of Alzheimer's disease. And as a practicing family doctor, it's not uncommon for me to have people come in and wonder whether or not they've got the beginning of a memory problem. Gait disturbance may be the beginning.
Back to the phones now, Zorba, and let me welcome our next caller, a listener in Houston, Texas. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
When riding a horse over jumps, which is what I do on a daily basis, basically, whether that has an effect or an adverse effect on your brain. I'm not talking about when you fall off and hurt yourself, hit your head on the ground or whatever, but the effect on your brain or your head or whatever from the motion or the impact, however you want to describe it, of going over jumps.
Interesting question. Why do you ask it? Have you had an experience or a friend or a relative had an experience with horse riding that you think may have affected them?
Well, I myself have fallen off and hit my head on the ground. You know, we wear protective helmets that are certified by the, whatever certification for safety. And I personally, I think, have experienced depression from that, which I've had to get over.
Oh, sure. Is that a horse in the background that I'm hearing right now, too?
Yeah, I'm at a horse show in Kentucky, in Lexington, at the Kentucky Horse Park.
I love it. I've been to Lexington. A couple of things here, first of all. As you said, the head trauma aside, wearing a helmet that's certified, whatever that certification is of course a critical issue. And I've done a bit of research on head injuries because of soccer, which is a very common issue. And I don't think there's any evidence at this time that jumping causes head injuries in and of itself. I don't think there's they may cause neck injuries and back injuries, and you may have injuries from that because you're jumping up and down. But I don't think there's any evidence that it causes head injuries. And I don't think there's any evidence that it causes depression. I don't think there's any evidence for that. Now, when you jump, how often are you do this on a regular basis, I take it?
Well, here at the show, you know, you do it several times a day whenever your classes are occurring. And, you know, let's see, probably during the week when I'm at home, maybe three times a week minimum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that your head is safe. I don't think you have to worry about your head. I don't think you have to worry about your brain at all. I think making sure that you do the right stretching exercises, as I'm sure you may do right now, to make sure that your spine stays good and stays supple is the important thing. And again, I don't think depression is an issue. Depression, of course, we know is common. It affects 5% mm-hmm. of the population. But I don't think jumping is likely to make you more depressed. And in fact, I think jumping, if you really, really like it and you do a great job, is more likely to make you happy than depressed.
Oh, yeah, it makes me very happy.
So thank you so much for your call.
No problem. Thank you.
You're welcome.
800-462-7413.
I have been to Lexington, and I love it. I've been there numerous times. Beautiful, beautiful farms. Beautiful, beautiful horses. Every time I go there, I think I should really learn to ride a horse, which I probably never will, other than a short ride. But they're just gorgeous animals, and that's horse country. Lexington, Louisville,
I lived in Lexington for 9 months.
For 9 months. Yeah. What did you do? It sounds like the amount of time to have a baby, 9 months.
Or go to school.
What did you major in? I don't want to know. All right.
Hard to believe. Communication studies.
Shocking.
800-462-7413. Zorba, time once again for our medical myth buster. And we have a listener myth today from Easton, who claims he's a big fan of the show. So let's make sure we can help him out. A recent show about nagging parental advice spurred this question on. Easton writes, truth or myth? Are carrots truly good for the eyes? I've been wearing glasses ever since I was 18 months old. I was also one of those kids that refused to eat veggies. I especially hated carrots. Yucky. I still don't like them. My parents told me that carrots were good for the eyes. Though I hated the taste of carrots, I ate them with the thought that one day I wouldn't need my glasses anymore. 30-plus years later, and I'm still wearing glasses, was I hoodwinked by my parents? He doesn't say whether after these 30 years he's still eating the carrots, even though he hates
them. Well, your parents did not hoodwink you. But the carrots are not, they're not going to improve your vision and make it so you don't need glasses. They're not going to improve decrease the risk of macular degeneration. Mm-hmm. But we do need beta carotene. We need it for night vision, and carrots are a really good source of beta carotene. You could also take a beta carotene supplement and toss the carrots, and that'll work for night vision. And we get beta carotene in other vegetables. One of the issues is that beta carotene, which by the way is in plentiful amounts in pumpkin. You don't have to eat carrots every day. You could have a spoonful of pumpkin and that would be just fine.
I think I'll take the carrots.
I think I'll take the carrots too. Hey, honey, let's open up a can of pumpkin and eat pumpkin right out of the can. Somehow just doesn't fit my kind of food that I like. But basically, there were researchers at Johns Hopkins back in the 90s who looked at 30,000 women in South Asia with vitamin deficiencies. And lo and behold, when they gave beta carotene tablets, vitamin A tablets, they had much, much less night blindness. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't improve your vision so you can take off your glasses. So your mom was right in some ways.
Yeah.
Give her a point. But in the other way, it wasn't. And you can stop eating your carrots and go take a vitamin.
Am I remembering right? I think you make a killer pumpkin soup.
I do.
Yeah.
I'm glad you remembered. I didn't even prompt you. I do make a killer pumpkin soup. We'll have it one day.
Have a myth you want busted? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And you can send your extra carrots to What's Up, Doc? D-O-C. 800-462-7416.
Thank you, Bugs. Thank you, Bugs.
Carterville, Illinois listener with us now. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, actually, I didn't have a question, but I did have just a comment or maybe a few suggestions in regards to one of your recent calls from a woman who I believe said she was a newlywed, and her husband was extremely ticklish. And I had some suggestions for ways that someone can actually work with ticklishness a little bit.
Yeah, I do remember that because I have extreme ticklishness. I mean, somebody even attempts to try to tickle me, even if they don't get close to me, and I immediately start either laughing or being uncomfortable. So you've got if you will, advice to the ticklish. Okay, advice to the ticklish.
Yeah. The first thing I would definitely recommend is that the person has not done any type of training or practice in deep belly breathing, deep diaphragmatic breathing, where you're pulling air, you know, further down into the belly and not just the chest, because that's always going to help everyone feel at least a little more calm and centered and grounded. Mm-hmm. And that can help you manage some of that anxiety. And so that's what I would start with. And then on top of that, actually, a person can put their hands down on their belly, and it could be, you know, the front or sides of the belly or the sides of the rib cage or the bottoms of the feet. Those are areas that, you know, are especially likely to be ticklish for someone.
Mm-hmm.
And just practice feeling and hearing that breath come down to the belly. Mm-hmm. And then, and you can also, if you're comfortable with having like a palm on that part of the body, you can use your fingertips, the middle fingertips, put them together and kind of press in and see if you can kind of find that area or that general region where you may feel ticklish. And then try to bring some of that big breath down to that area and meet your fingertips.
Oh, that's very interesting.
That can be done standing or seated, but I'd especially recommend doing it perhaps lying on your back with your knees bent and your feet flat on the floor or on a mat, or you could do it in bed, and maybe even have some pillows resting underneath your knees because that'll help that belly area relax a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You know, I find this, I'm obviously not doing it now because we're in the middle of the radio station, but it's sort of a desensitization process along with a visualization process. I find that really interesting. That might actually, because as I said, I cannot wash the bottom of my feet without feeling uncomfortable, but I have never worked on desensitizing myself to it.
You're really good. I'm feeling so calm listening to you.
Tom's asleep. He's asleep at the mic. I think that we'll get a lot of emails from the tickled out there, the tickled who have been looking for help, and I certainly got some good advice from that too, and we really appreciate
Thank you so much for the call. Why don't we try this? You practice those techniques right now. I'll come around and tickle you
I don't think it's going to work. That is not going to happen. So
before we punch out for the week, Zorba, let's settle up with the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. This week's citation comes to us from Deputy Mark in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Mark takes exception to your recent misuse of the phrase mano a mano, although he explains it's a pretty common misstep. Mark writes, mano a mano means hand to hand, not man to man. Rest assured, you're not alone. Mano a mano is hot property again. I have no idea why. It's right up there with the nauseating, just saying, it is what it is, and not in his or her wheelhouse. On the other hand...
Not in his or her wheelhouse? Now, that one I haven't heard. Not in his or her wheelhouse. That's a good one.
He continues, on the other hand, if you think about it for a minute, hand-to-hand has a kind of friendly ring to it, doesn't it?
It does.
But if you said, I'd like to see those two guys settle this thing hand-to-hand, it'd certainly conjure up something interesting, some interesting metal images.
I like there's nothing in the wheelhouse. I kind of like that one.
If you want to confront Zorba about his grammar mistakes, mano a mano, then use your mano to type up an email and send it to the show at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Friedrich and technical director Brad Kohlberg, the Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny of Wisconsin Public Radio, are the two guys responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0728Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.